Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition, now airing on Fridays. Today on our show, we visit a high school in Merced where students take a year-long class focusing solely on mental health. And we find out why hundreds of people flock to a Bakersfield funeral home this weekend. Not for a memorial service, but a festival. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. We also speak with a Los Banos champion for the multiracial movement about her new memoir, and we look behind the newsroom veil and share how we find our stories and how we ensure that they're accurate and balanced.
But first, a recap of this week's news. MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews aired live from Fresno State Monday. The guest, Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg, whom Matthews lauded as a rising star. Here's what the now mayor of South Bend, Indiana, said about President Donald Trump's latest tariffs and how they're affecting local farmers.
The products that are grown here are world class. And yet, what we're finding is that because of a short-sighted, I can't even call it a policy. It's a pattern. It's a pattern of poking people in the eye to see what'll happen.
Buttigieg also took audience questions and told the packed room he thinks the president should be impeached. Matthews pushed him further. Would he do it now if he were a member of Congress? Buttigieg said yes.
And just outside the event, I caught up with a man named Campaign Joe. At least, that's what he calls himself. He's been traveling the country for the past 12 years, hawking campaign merchandise, T-shirts, hats, at events for the major candidates. His theory on elections? Whoever sells the most merchandise wins.
Obama sold the most in 08 by a long shot. He won. He sold way more than Romney in 2012. Trump sold more than anybody in 16. He won. By the looks of things, he's going to win again.
And Carrie, I asked him what he thought about the standing room only audience at this Hardball event, and he said it's nothing like a Trump rally. He compared the two, saying it was preschool versus a doctorate degree.
Well, we'll see how things heat up in the next year. But speaking of politics, Kern County Sheriff Donnie Youngblood announced earlier this week that he'd be cutting his gang unit and reassigning those deputies to other departments. He cited budget issues.
We're running out of people. And we're unable to recruit and retain more than we're losing. So we're getting smaller and smaller, and this is just probably the beginning of more cuts to come.
Also in Bakersfield, longtime city manager Alan Tandy announced he'll be retiring in December after 27 years on the job. And Bakersfield is the second city in Kern County, following Delano, to approve adding the motto, "In God We Trust," to city-owned police and fire vehicles.
Lastly, the Bakersfield, California newspaper is being sold to a Canadian company known as Sound News Media. And heading outdoors, the Kings River is now closed to all recreation in Kings, Tulare, and Fresno counties. That's due to dangerous conditions because of water releases from Pine Flat Dam.
Listen for more FM89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. When it comes to access to mental health care at public schools, California ranks at or near the bottom, according to a recent Columbia University report. But one Merced high school is going against that tide with an entire course dedicated to mental health. As FM89's Laura Satsui reports, kids are responding so positively, they're becoming advocates themselves.
Jonathan Swart wasn't sure he'd graduate on time.
I was homeless at 14, so all these things just kind of, fed into, me ended up getting picked up in foster care. So, I didn't really care about school.
He was a junior at Merced High School when he found out he didn't have enough credits to finish in 4 years. So he started attending Yosemite High School. It's considered a last resort for kids at risk of not graduating. And let's just say he was wary of authority types.
If they're doing their job because it's their job and they get paid for it, and they're not really doing it as far as, they want to, make a change or, really try and help a kid. We can tell, you know, and we'll call it 9 times out of 10, you know, we'll call it every time.
But then he met Viviana Barajas. He and other students had weekly meetings where she would teach them how to shift their perspectives and why paying attention to mental health matters. It wasn't long before Swart and his peers had an idea.
We just started cracking jokes. We're like, well, we're in here so damn much, we might as well just make it a class. And then, like, we did. Like, it started out, it literally started out as a joke.
Barajas took their idea and developed a curriculum for a mental health, wellness, and advocacy course, and got it approved. She taught the class this year for the first time, with Swart as one of her students.
When the kids can learn why they make decisions that they do, when they can learn that the challenges in their life, you know, these labels that they've had, you know, how that affects them.
They covered common mental health challenges for teens and how brains develop what Barajas calls pathways.
So we can't change what's happened to them in the past, but we can change, build new pathways where they can see things through a different lens.
Now, Barajas wasn't hired to be a teacher. Her background is in counseling, and she's a certified Nurtured Heart Approach trainer. But she says that approach helps her work with students. The gist of it is positive reinforcement.
I'm a ninja at looking at the positive. So, I mean, I can, even if he just got into a fight, I'm like, wow, he handled this really nicely. Or, you know, he was able to calm down in 5 minutes instead of 8 minutes. So I tend to look at things through such a positive lens that I couldn't say that I've ever worked with a youth that this did not work with.
And with the mental health class, there seems to be a correlation. This year, students enrolled did better academically than those who weren't. Some of Barajas' students even created an after-school club to spread awareness about mental health and access to services. They call it the Greatness Project. On this day, only a few kids attend. It's the end of the year, but they're working on a promotional video.
For the introduction, was like, I feel like teachers really think it's easy. As easy as stay safe this weekend, see you Monday, have fun, kids, stay safe. Like, man.
Sitting in a circle with Barajas, Jonathan Swart reads from a script.
I really wish it was that easy. Like, don't get me wrong, we can't expect them to understand how it is out there.
Jayla Boyle nods her head with the music as Swart continues. Boyle graduated last semester, but she still comes back to campus every week for club meetings. Like Swart, she was in foster care and moved around a lot.
From there, like, I was having problems all the time. Like, I was throwing Chromebooks at students, throwing things at teachers, throwing Chromebooks over the balcony.
A teacher suggested she talk to Barajas.
Like, when Ms. V was talking to me, like, I was checking her. I was like, can I trust you? And then she was just talking to me and talking to me, and I was like, wow, like, she really gets me, like, when I was opening up to her.
She says being in Barajas' mental health class and collaborating with other advocacy groups for the Greatness Project have changed her life.
Like, people labeling us, like, oh, that's the bad kid school. Mm-hmm. Just being where we are today and, like coming together with other organizations, it makes you feel, like, really good. Like, we're the bad kid school, and we're almost at the top.
Boyle doesn't throw Chromebooks anymore, and she tries to focus on the positives. When she catches herself getting mad or upset, she resets, takes a deep breath, and reminds herself that it's okay. Marilyn Moschel is with the Merced County National Alliance on Mental Illness. She says Merced has a lot of needs, but not a lot of funding. So she's excited to see teens advocating for a class and club that address mental health awareness.
If nobody says anything, nothing will change. And then we know what the result is. We can look around today and see it.
The club is even seeking board members and filling out paperwork to become a nonprofit so the students can raise money and help youth in Merced. Here's Swart again.
Like, it sounds kind of cheesy, you know, but it's like Spider-Man movies, you know? If you have the option to help somebody, like, it almost kind of makes it a responsibility, you know? Because if you can't help somebody, like, why wouldn't you, you know?
And Swart graduated this week. This summer, he's going to be certified to teach the Nurtured Heart Approach and wants to keep working with the Greatness Project. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui in Merced.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. The San Joaquin Valley has its share of unique summer celebrations. Take the Horned Toad Festival over Memorial Day weekend in Coalinga, or the Mendota Cantaloupe Festival in July. But a new festival to the Valley drew hundreds to Bakersfield this past weekend, and my co-host, FM89 reporter Carrie Klein, is just dying to tell us about it.
Standing outside the festival is Jim Lamar. He likes to run and work out, and he's excited to meet other Bakersfield athletes, like Amanda Duquette, who's chatting with a friend under a shady tree.
I so admire you. I'm telling you.
She's a runner and weightlifter here. She's pretty ripped.
It's been almost 10 years that I've been training or working out. And
but when they start talking about body fat, the conversation takes an unexpected turn.
So I would cremate really quick.
Yeah, like you would go great, but we ought to give you a prize, a break out the prize.
Right? No, thank you.
Yeah, they're talking about cremation. That's because they're standing outside Green Lawn Funeral Homes and Cemeteries at the Before I Die Festival, a one-day affair all about end-of-life issues. Lamar is Green Lawn's president and one of the festival's hosts. And Duquette, she just took a tour of the crematorium.
I've always been interested in cremation, and the tour was really cool. And just learning about, you know, the different times bodies take in there, just kind of that aspect is kind of intriguing, I think.
The more fat you've got, the longer you burn. Lamar had an urn full of fun facts like this.
The number one popular place for scattering cremated remains in the United States?
Vegas.
Disneyland.
Oh, yeah.
The happiest place on earth. Yes, true story.
Around 150 people have come out today. Yes, baby boomers making their own plans, but also 20 and 30 somethings here out of curiosity.
Anybody wanting to go on the mortuary tour, we're going to just walk across the parking lot and start over there.
The day is anything but stiff, with talks about estate planning and hospice care, an obituary writing workshop, and even a tour of an embalming facility. People need jokes to lighten that one up.
It's like liposuction.
The star of the day, though, is that crematorium tour. Noelia Citialine is fascinated by a photo of a pile of bones. That's what's ground up into cremated remains.
Like, I didn't really anticipate to see that, because you imagine, you know, the heat so high that it's just all gone, but that they still actually have to deal with remains and all of that. It's very morbid.
Later, Citialine points out her car for me in the parking lot. She drives a hearse. The festival was organized by Gail Rubin, who's literally a certified death expert, or thanatologist. An Albuquerque native, she's wearing a collared shirt and cowboy boots embroidered with colorful skulls.
So come on down! Woo-hoo!
Inspired by longer Before I Die festivals elsewhere, she teamed up with Jim Lamar and an ad agency for the first festival jam-packed into one day. She kicks it off with a game.
We're playing the newly dead game. Come on, sit down, grab yourself a sheet.
Yeah, she said newly dead game, a multiple choice quiz about end-of-life prep. Like, do you have a will or a burial plan, and are they in writing? That's the icebreaker. Next up, Ruben hosts an informal discussion, which she calls a death cafe.
Well, my main motto is just like talking about sex won't make you pregnant, talking about funerals and end-of-life issues won't make you dead.
The dozens of strangers here today are into it. They share deeply personal stories of spreading ashes, moving through grief, and self-forgiveness, all with laughter. Ruben says tackling these subjects head-on is kind of the point in what she calls a death-averse society.
This provides the opportunity for people to get their questions answered, to come to a funeral home for something other than a funeral, and come away laughing and learning and hopefully being better prepared to deal with this inevitability for our lives.
It worked for Carol Faber, who drove here from Tehachapi with her husband, David. She's 72, he's 60, and they thought they knew what they wanted.
Before this, I was like, just put me in the dumpster. I don't really care.
Our plan is to get cremated, and then we both have spots in the ocean that we want to be spread at.
But now they say maybe we will get graves or memorials for the kids to visit. Granted, more customers is exactly what Green Lawn Funeral Home wants, and part of the reason it hosted this festival. Still, it was an opportunity for David Faber to finally ask one of his burning questions. Does anyone ever wake up in the cremator?
I want to make sure I'm dead before I get cremated. That's always, I've always told her.
He's got that in his little letter to the kids, make sure I'm dead.
Funeral directors told him his body would have been sitting for days. He'd be long dead.
That made me feel a little bit better. So you ready to go?
Yep.
Okay.
So what to do after an event like this? Take a somber ride home, visit a lawyer, maybe call the kids? Nah. The Fabers have something else in mind.
Actually, we're going to go see Rocket Man.
They don't see the point in being worried to death. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein. You're listening listening to Valley Edition. The cost of healthcare in the U.S. has become so untenable that many news outlets now highlight outrageous medical bills, like a $100,000 heart attack or a $56,000 ambulance ride in Texas. But what about the people stuck with costs that aren't as shocking, but are still really tough to pay? For them, there's a new podcast called An Arm and a Leg. It's by former NPR reporter Dan Weissman, who just this week launched season 2. I spoke with him, but before we begin our chat, here's an excerpt from the new trailer.
One thing I've said from the beginning, I am never going to run out of material for this show. And that's definitely checking out. So, here comes season 2.
I don't know which was worse, the pain or the fear of what is this going to cost me. But it was a pretty gnarly situation.
I called 911.
He called 911, and my first thing was, we don't have health insurance. Yeah. Don't do anything.
We just got in the car. As we're walking out of the house, the fire truck and ambulance are pulling up to the front of our house. They're like passing us, like walking out. We're doing one, you know, covering our faces. It wasn't us that called, kind of thing.
So we wanted to make sure that this was actually correct because it seemed insane.
And I asked the CEO of one of the hospitals in California, like, why you charge so much for a hip replacement? He literally said, because sometimes a Saudi sheik comes in with a suitcase full of cash.
That's all coming June 4th, wherever you get podcasts, or go to armandalegshow.com. Till then, take care of yourself.
So that sounds great. I mean, I really want to hear these stories.
Oh, thank you. That's awesome. Good.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the inspiration for this podcast?
Oh, boy. Well, I had been trying for years when I was a reporter working for Marketplace and for WBEZ. I'd been pitching something like this to people I worked for and saying, like, this is enormous. And these stories, as kind of it says in the trailer, you know, they have everything because they are super intimate and they go up to the very kind of highest levels of, like, economics and politics and policy. So, like, what's not to like? And I think everybody was like, that's great, Dan, but we hired you to do this other thing. We still need you to keep doing that.
Right.
So when I left the last job I had, I was like, I could think about freelancing, but, like, where would the health insurance come from? So there was a very immediate impetus, too. There was a very personal side to it, which was like, well, man, like, this is actually the number one issue in my life right now. And that became part of season 1, of course.
Right. This is personal for you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So things do work out for you, you know, in the end, at least in terms of choosing an insurance plan. Knock on wood. They've worked out for
right.
now.
So far, so good.
Yeah. But in one of your episodes, I think this is episode 4, you know, you're talking with kind of experts about just the frustration about choosing a health insurance plan. So here in this particular clip I'm about to play, you're talking with a woman named Lynn. She runs a nonprofit healthcare help center in D.C., and she's talking about how helpless people feel when choosing their health insurance plans. And she's just told you that surveys show that people literally would rather go to the gym or do their taxes than choose a plan. So I'll play this clip.
They feel that there's something in the fine print they probably missed. So people really want an expert to sit right next to them and help them say this is, in fact, the right health plan.
And she says, this is a smart instinct. Me, I walked in kind of overconfident. I asked Lynn, can I just make a spreadsheet with the deductibles and stuff?
Your health plan could have different deductibles. It could have a general deductible, it could have a pharmaceutical deductible, it could have a hospital deductible.
You're making me feel like going to the gym or doing my taxes.
Exactly.
So you really just captured the frustration of this whole process right there.
Yeah. And luckily, I was talking to somebody that smart and knowledgeable who could tell me, like, no, you. If you think you're smart enough to do this by yourself, you're dumber than you think.
Sounds about right. And so then, you know, one thing I like about this podcast, too, is that you supplement all of this with really engaging personal stories. And so here's a guy named Blake, a patient who you speak with for episode 6. He's really busted up his knee, and he's told you all about the process of getting a brace for it from the doctor. Here's the clip.
Doctors at a local hospital told him he needed a brace on his leg, and they sent him downstairs to get one. Bam, this thing locks his knee into place.
It's a wonderful device. I mean, it's I love it. I called it the Iron Maiden.
He went into work that day a happy man.
And I was thinking, you know, I wonder what they're going to charge the insurance company for this brace. And I looked on the side and I'm like, hey, you know, Google it. And I Google it. And
$150. He figures there'll be a little markup.
I kind of put it in the back of my head. Enjoyed using the brace as much as possible. Yeah, and then the bill came.
And what did it say?
$1,400.
Whoa.
So what I like about this is that it's kind of an everyman story, right? I mean, a lot of folks need medical aids of some sort, and they can probably sympathize with something like that that happens.
Yeah, it's so easy to imagine, right? And and of course, the punchline is that Blake finds this out from getting a statement from his insurance company that says, like, ah, those guys wanted to charge you $1,400. We told them $600, not a penny more. And because you haven't paid your deductible, you're on the hook for the $600. So he's actually expected to pay $600 for a thing he could have ordered himself on Amazon for $150.
Right. And that's almost a lesson right there for listeners, too, for how to do some actual price shopping. So these are, you know, both of these clips that I've played so far, you know, these are stories about the frustrations, the difficulties of you know, shopping for health insurance, of getting medical care. But the purpose of the show is not just to make listeners feel desperate and helpless, right?
No, we hope not. No, that would be bad, because then no one would listen to a second episode ever.
Right.
No, we're always trying to figure out, like, well, what have I learned? What can I use? And to kind of be good company. This is a show that's intended to be entertaining and intended to be a little, to the greatest extent it's possible, to be empowered in this crazy environment, to be empowering. And so we're always looking for, you know, what's a potentially usable takeaway here, including, like, I'm not all alone in this.
So season two is out right now. What does that look like and what's new this time around?
The first thing that's new is a lot of the stories came straight from listeners. So when we were doing season one, we asked people to send in stories, and people really, really did. And so it was a little overwhelming, in fact, starting to kind of make the story list for season two. Like, well, which of this incredible array of mind-blowing stories, in a lot of cases, will we use and will we feature? And so I think we picked some good ones, and there's lots more where they came from. And so that's a big thing. And in fact, in episode two, there's a couple of things that don't sound like they came from listeners, but they did. They're like, these are experts or actually kind of hospital administrators that I was kind of tipped off to the existence of these folks by a tip that came in from a listener very early on. So that's a huge thing. It was one of the things I hoped for in starting the show, was that it wouldn't just be addressing an audience, but really engaging a community of people, and would be a conversation. And so far people have totally come through with that, and it's awesome. And the other thing is that we're looking, we take a long look, and it's in some ways it's really just the beginning, just scratching the surface, at what's probably the biggest question of all, which is, how did things get so expensive? How did the prices get so high? And we look at three examples. One of them is an MRI. From listeners, I got four different price tags for three MRIs. One of them, it was one person who went in for an MRI and ended up getting basically two different price tags. And the range was from, the sticker price range was from $1,000 to $26,000.
Oh my gosh.
And the after insurance was from, well, $0 in one case, really, but to then $98 to $2,000. More than 2,000. So we really look at, like, okay, what happened here? And we get help. Actually, this is another new thing from a woman named Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's the editor-in-chief of this amazing nonprofit news organization called Kaiser Health News. They're not related to Kaiser Permanente, except they share an ancestor. In the case of Kaiser Health News, a benefactor, a guy who died a long time ago. She wrote a book about the cost of healthcare. She was a reporter for the New York Times. Now she runs this organization, and she steps in to kind of bat cleanup on that episode and say, like, here's the deal. Here's why MRIs are priced so crazily. We also look at prescription drugs, and we look at insulin, which is a kind of unavoidable one, and turns out to be fascinating. The answer, in some ways, to why insulin's so expensive goes back to when it was discovered. Almost 100 years ago, almost exactly 100 years ago, in 1921. So these instances are really, really revealing and interesting. So we're getting a chance to dig a little deeper into some specifics this time.
Well, it sounds fabulous. I can't wait to listen. Dan Weissman is a podcaster based in Chicago. His podcast about healthcare costs called An Arm and a Leg is debuting its second season this week. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. Susan Graham is white, but her children's father is black. And while raising her now adult children, she noticed there wasn't a biracial option for them to choose on their school and medical forms. Since then, she's helped change that. Graham also founded Project Race, or Reclassify All Children Equally. The activist and Los Banos resident joins FM 89 reporter Monica Velez to talk about her recent memoir, Born Biracial, How One Mother Took on Race in America.
In the beginning of your memoir, there's this moment where you suddenly have to start thinking about your children's race when the U.S. Census form arrives. Tell us more about that moment.
Well, when I received my 1990 census form, I realized that there was no place on the form for my children's races. You had to pick only one race, and I couldn't do that because my children are black and white. So I called the Census Bureau, and they kept putting me on hold and telling me that they didn't know what the answer was. Finally, they came back and said, the children take the race of the mother. And I said, why arbitrarily the mother? Why not the father? And his voice became very hushed, and he said, because in cases like these, we know who the mother is and not the father. And that incensed me so much that that's the reason the Project Race started.
So in the book, you know, there's a lot of terms mentioned, like multicultural, multiracial, biracial, bicultural. Can you kind of explain that more and what terminology might be better used?
I think the terminology is extremely important. Depends on what you call a child, and the child needs to know that there's a word for them. Multiracial people are asked all the time, what are you? And what that question means is, what race are you? And for a multiracial child to be able to answer very confidently, I'm biracial or I'm multiracial, makes a difference in them knowing who they are, which is extremely important for our children. We don't use the term mixed at Project Race, and the reason we don't use it is because it lends itself to mixed up, mixed nuts, that kind of thing that we see as newspaper headlines when talking about multiracial people. And also, I thought about it one day and thought that mixed is the opposite of pure. And I don't think we want to go there. I don't think we want to separate people in America by being pure and not pure. So biracial and multiracial are the two designations that we prefer.
And on your journey trying to find out why there wasn't a box for multiracial people, you write about how one person told you that what you were doing was really dangerous. So why was that?
Well, he said that it was dangerous because it was dismantling the one-drop rule in America. And the one-drop rule says if you have one drop of black blood, you're black. And we don't believe that's true. And we believe that you can be more than one race. And so that's why he thought that it was dangerous to do what I was doing, because it had been kind of the law for so long.
And how did the multiracial movement start in this country? And how did the organization you started, Project Race, play a role in that movement?
Well, we started the movement, and nothing was being done before we came on the scene. Very little was being done. I think Berkeley, California had interracial on their school forms, but that was about it. So we just dug in. When we started Project Race, I basically knew nothing about politics. And I learned very quickly, and there was a woman in Cincinnati who was trying to get a bill passed to put multiracial on school forms. And I found her, and together we started Project Race. And our first legislation that was passed was in the state of Ohio that mandated that multiracial be put on the school forms. And then we went to other states, and it's really a grassroots movement. You know, we started locally, we started in our own backyards, we started at our own schools, and we bubbled up to finally get to Washington and influence the Washington lawmakers and the census people.
And so what ended up happening in your fight to get multiracial as a box in the census forms?
What we got was the ability to check more than one race, which we accepted as it was a compromise They didn't want to just have a multiracial box, and we wanted more than having to check just one race. So we compromised with the Census Bureau and got the ability to check more than one race. The distractors from the movement, or the people who didn't want us to do this, they claimed that their races would lose numbers because people would jump to the multiracial category. That's not actually what happened. People who use the multiracial category used to use a category called other. So they jump from other to multiracial or checking more than one. They don't jump from necessarily black or Asian to suddenly being multiracial. The other thing that we got that is extremely important is the ability to self-identify who you are. Used to be, if a parent didn't designate a race for their child, a teacher was told to pick a race for that child based on her observation and knowledge of the child. So the teacher could pick whatever they wanted to call the child on the education forms. So data was really messed up in this country. With my son, he was considered to be black at school, white on the census, and multiracial at home. Anybody can look at that and say, data is really messed up. Something had to be done. So we set out to do that.
And how'd you end up living in the Valley?
I married someone who grew up in Los Banos.
And, I mean, I know that a lot of your work started in Georgia, but did you see any similarities between what you were doing in Georgia over here to the Valley?
I think that people in California were more open to talking about it, to discussing it. It wasn't, you know, the kind of old South that we ran into sometimes in Georgia, although Atlanta was very progressive, I think, in doing this. Georgia was one of our states that passed multiracial legislation. California is one of our states that is a sponsor of Multiracial Heritage Week. People think that California be easier than the South, but we have, for Multiracial Heritage Week, for example, we have California, we have Texas, we have Hawaii, Ohio, Colorado, so many states that are coming to support multiracial people. We can't say that it's just one geographical area.
And throughout the memoir, you write about how being a longtime activist took a toll on your personal relationships. What was it like going through that? And why do you think it's so difficult to find that balance between work and your personal life?
I think for me, work became my personal life because I was talking about my children and wanting to do what was right for my children. And I couldn't just separate my work life from my personal life. It became one. And it took its toll in different ways. And father of my children and I are divorced, and I've remarried. And so I think a lot of that happened because of working as an advocate. Advocacy work is extremely difficult. One of the reasons I wrote the book was so that people will, you know, learn how to be advocates, learn from my successes and mistakes, what to do if you want to make change in this world and what not to do. So it's kind of a primer for advocates.
And what's next for Project Grace? Are you going to continue your activism work?
Hopefully. I was thinking about it this morning because now we're getting into Multiracial Heritage Week. And I was thinking about it that we do this state by state, but it's just about time. I think after the next election, we'll try to get a presidential proclamation for the entire country. You know, we've done this for 6 years now, state by state, and it's time to go national. So that's hopefully what we'll be doing next.
We are speaking with Susan Graham about her memoir, Born Biracial, How One Mother Took on Race in America. She'll be at the Barnes & Noble tomorrow, June 8th, in Fresno for a book signing from 1 to 3 to kick off Multicultural Heritage Week. Thanks for being with us, Susan.
Thank you.
Now that we've moved Valley Edition to Friday, we figured it would be a good time to introduce the news team, whose award-winning features help make up the show's content. Today in our studio, moderator Kathleen Chalk talks to reporters Carrie Klein, Laura Satsui, and Monica Velez about the process of finding and producing accurate and interesting stories.
So I'm really excited to draw back the curtain a little bit and take a look at how this team operates and how you go about bringing news to your listeners. So just to start out, a question I know you hear quite often, how do you find your stories?
So there are a lot of different ways, I think. The kind of the most straightforward ones are the stories that come to us. Like we're reading the news. We're reading all the time. We're checking social media for people locally, for things that are happening nationally that might have an effect locally. But also a lot of it is just organic conversations with people in the area here. And whether that's, you know, either, you know, people kind of cold pitching us ideas, which happens with listeners, or maybe we'll already be out on an interview and they'll say some kind of comment that kind of sticks with you. One particular story that comes to mind is like on Twitter, we happen to be seeing a conversation about valley fever, the fungal disease I cover a lot. And there's a woman who was talking about struggling with pregnancy and the valley fever medication. And that's not a story that I would have really heard anywhere else. It's very rare kind of to be in that situation. But because she was on Twitter and she tweeted at us, that turned into a great story after that.
That's great. Thanks, Carrie. Laura, I'm curious, how long does it take you to put together, let's say, a 5-minute feature story?
Yeah, those are the stories that we honestly, it seems like the shortest story, but it takes the longest time. And so I try to think of it in terms of working on it for a week. And like within a week, I will have all my interviews planned. I will be going through all of that tape and then writing up that script. So maybe, you know, Monday, start doing those interviews. And then by Friday, the story is done and aired. But at the same time, sometimes I get pitched a story or I find a story maybe 2 weeks out and then I'm thinking about it and making sort of preliminary phone calls. And that happens over the course of a week or two, something like that. It seems like it takes not a lot of time, but there's so much planning and just thinking about it. And even when I'm not at work, just ruminating on it. And maybe you guys can relate. You dream about it or you go to the gym and you're still thinking.
Totally. Yeah. It's on my mind all the time.
Monica, could you talk us through the process? When you come up with a great story idea, how do you internally decide, yes, this is something we're going to move forward with?
So one of the really big things that I always think about is what kind of communities and how many people do certain issues affect.
And I think at the same time, you mentioned communities being affected, but also stakeholders. We're always talking to who's involved in the process, who has something at stake. So it's often government, it's often community groups, it's often families, sort of in your immigration example. But like I did a story on liquor licenses, and it was a lot of community groups concerned about kids having or being in close proximity to alcohol if there are liquor stores near schools. And so being able to talk to families who lived near those liquor stores and in oversaturated areas, but also the council members who are voting on this. So I guess I always think about it in terms of, like Monica said, communities, but really stakeholders and people who you might not just run into and talk to about this.
And I would imagine Carrie, maybe you could comment on this. It's a collaborative process, yes? It's not just, I want to do this story and I'm doing this story.
No, definitely. We're always talking about this all together as a newsroom. We're meeting really regularly and talking about, you know, how do we balance being reactive to what's going on now and public affairs, current affairs, but also balancing that out with kind of the more, you know, maybe in-depth things that aren't quite as timely, but still really important. And then, of course, we also, in each show, at least every week on Valley Edition, we at least want to have something that's like that's lighthearted in some way and not necessarily so newsy. But yeah, we make a lot of these decisions together as a news team.
So this might sound like a silly question, but I think it's an important one for listeners to hear or for you to address. How do you go about ensuring that the information you report is accurate?
I think a lot of that comes down to trusting our sources and, you know, being able to attribute that information to them. You know, we don't often report things anonymously. We ensure that if we do get an anonymous tip or something like that, we find someone who can say, yeah, I can vouch that this is true, or yeah, I'm a scientist and this is true. That's who I often rely on, people who will tie their name to it and say, yeah, I have experienced this for a fact. And that's why we often say such and such says. And if we can confirm it through, you know, some other report, like maybe it's printed out, it's a budget, and the numbers are there, then we know that's printed, it's been reported by a specific agency. So that's true. But usually it's just finding other people to confirm it and getting as many of those confirmations as possible, not just blatantly saying, well, I heard this through the grapevine. It's out there now.
Right. Because having factual information is so critical to your credibility as journalist. Monica, maybe you could talk a little bit about why it is so important to ensure your credibility in order to do your job.
Yeah, well, I mean, as reporters, your credibility is kind of all you have. It's really important to your reporting to always try to be as accurate as you can. And, you know, it's one of those things like, you know, we're only human. We make mistakes, too. And the important part about making mistakes for us is that when we realize that we have made a mistake, we go to the story immediately, change it, and kind of make a little note that says, hey, like, we messed up on this. This is the right information.
If it's breaking news, we're trying to talk to people as fast as we can. And that's why we do update stories. And we also, you know, we want to get things right the first time, but we are responsive to when audience members or listeners come back to us and say, hey, I think that was wrong. And you know, we'll admit it if we can confirm otherwise, right?
But that doesn't happen very often, though.
Right, yeah.
But I will say, too, that I think that there's a misconception out there that a lot of people think that journalists go out there looking for one specific thing, that we already have a narrative in our head, and then we only look for those viewpoints
like
that support that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's really not the way that this works. I mean, you know, if a story features maybe three voices or three interviews, those are generally not the only people that we've spoken with. We've done a lot of pre-interviewing too with lots of other, as Laura, you know, talked about, stakeholders to make sure that this is the story that really exists. This is at least, you know, the perspective that at least some people in the community feel. And so, you know, we're doing our best to represent that rather than invent it.
Great. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're here talking with the members of the KVPR news team. Along these lines, and thank you, Carrie, for your comments. Laura, I'd like to switch the conversation to a specific story that you wrote. So, you know, as a journalist, you are reporting on events in real time. And of course, we know the objective truth of a situation as defined by one person. Mm-hmm. It's not always the same as how it's defined by another person.
Sure.
So I'd like to talk about the steps that you have taken to represent all sides when reporting a story, specifically taking a look at a recent report that you did about a 2020 ballot initiative that could change some provisions of the what has been considered a very controversial Proposition 13.
Yeah, Prop 13. And so how, you know, what some people interpreted that what the effects of Prop 13 are and what repealing it or parts of it might mean. Yeah. So when I so kind of going back to how we find stories, the county assessor's office actually sort of pitched me that story. I got a phone call where they said, hey, we'd love to talk to you about this, or we want to kind of inform you about what we think is going on, how this might affect us. And then, and at that point, I didn't know enough about the county assessor to even move anywhere forward with this story in particular. So I had a lot of conversations just figuring out, okay, what does a county assessor even do? What does this even mean? And then I had to go back and look at Prop 13, because that was the other side of it. And then I had to look at what this new ballot measure for 2020, which seems really far away, who the people were that even brought that forward. And then had a lot of conversations with our editor, Alice, about it. And when I wrote my first draft, you know, we realized that I had written something that was giving a lot of time to people who were against the 2020 ballot measure than people who were for it. And we had to go back and say, okay, why do I think that is? And I think because I had been pitched this story by one side, it kind of made it harder for me to start to think all the way around the issue, and I hadn't quite made my way to making all the phone calls I could have possibly made. And so I just had to go back to the drawing board a little bit and say, okay, who haven't I talked to? Who is still being affected? And then getting even more voices. And by the end, we tried to, you know, be as fair as we could and make sure, you know, like Carrie says, the people who are affected, those, that's their opinion, but get, you know, also asking them, like, well, what are you hearing from other people as well?
It's a great example of the importance of collaboration in order to ensure you can present stories as objectively and in an unbiased manner.
Right. Yeah. I couldn't write this story if I didn't have Alice to edit it, or if I didn't have my coworkers to bounce ideas off of and say, hey, does this sound okay, or something like that.
So, Monica, you recently reported a really fascinating story out of Bakersfield about a priest who was accused of sexual abuse. And there was a lot of tension in terms of how the community was reacting to those allegations. Can you tell us a little bit about what drew you to that story and the approach that you took in terms of getting both sides of that controversial situation?
So for this story, to me, what kind of stood out about it? Well, one, you know, it was being reported by various outlets. But the one thing that was really interesting to me was there's this longtime priest in the community that is very well loved by a lot of people, has helped a lot of people. And he was being accused of some, you know, really terrible things. And there was just an overwhelming support. Like, I'm talking hundreds of people who showed up to really rally for him and kind of say, no, like, we don't believe these accusations. This priest would never do that. And so the way that I approached it was I really looked at how this can impact a community. A lot of people not believing someone who was allegedly a victim of some, you know, of some sexual abuse. And to give this perspective, I also talked to a professor at Stanford, and he has been looking into research about sexual abuse by priests specifically for 30 years plus. And so he was able to really give this story a perspective, kind of, you know, a researcher and an unbiased kind of look at the situation. So that brought a lot of insight into the story as well.
That's great. So before we wrap up this conversation, I want to talk to you, Carrie, specifically about a series of reports that you have done recently called In Recovery, about opioid use in the San Joaquin Valley. As listeners of the show, I'm sure know, the series is supported by a 2018 data fellowship from the USC Center for Health Journalism. Can you just briefly explain what that means for listeners?
There's a department down at USC which is all about health journalism, and the majority of what they do is support reporters in California and around the country to do really important, impactful health reporting. And so this is a fellowship where they bring me in for a week to do some professional development. We learn about data analysis. We learn about kind of the important health topics that are out there. We network with other journalists, and they give us a small stipend also to go and report kind of a big in-depth series for about 6 months was the amount of time that I had.
That's great. So tell me a little bit more specifically about the story you did for that series on Oildale. What I found really interesting about it is that it demonstrated the complexity and the ambiguity associated with reporting on a public health issue of this magnitude. I mean, you even at one point posed the question, is the problem getting better or worse? And I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about your approach for tackling something this complicated and massive?
Yeah, this was a really tough story to produce because, you know, what I think really the impetus for it was, you know, again, this data fellowship, I was producing a whole series of stories about opioid use and abuse. And part of that is when I was going around and talking with lots of people, I just started by fanning out, just calling people up, health officials, community members, you know, people in treatment or counselors, and just saying, what are the stories here I should be looking at? And people kept over and over telling me, oh, Oildale, you should be looking at Oildale, especially if I'm talking about Kern County. Oh, yeah, Oildale, lots of drugs there. And people are really kind of flippant with that kind of, you know, the reputation that Oildale has as of being this kind of drug center. And so I was fascinated from that point. But then, you know, you dig into the state has a wealth of data on opioid overdoses and who's affected. And, you know, I noticed that in the span of 1 year, the number of deaths, of overdose deaths due to opioids in Oildale dropped precipitously. I think it was from 16 deaths 1 year to 3 the next. And that really piqued my curiosity, because it was like, this is a tremendous drop. You know, was it just a fluke, or is it something that actually is part of a trend? And so that was what was really the seed for the story. You know, and there are tons of caveats, as you said. I mean, it's a hard question to answer, and I didn't try to answer it and myself become the expert there to answer it. But I presented all sides, and I really focused on what community members there are seeing. When the experts aren't sure, they're not sure what to do with the data, you know, I basically found other experts, which is the people who actually live there and do community work there. And they were able to tell me what they were seeing. And yes, this still is a tremendous problem, but there's a lot of hope in that community. And, you know, a lot of the community advocates feel like there is improvement. And so, you know, that's a story in and of itself, whether or not the data actually shows that.
That's an optimistic note to end on. I want to thank you all for taking the time. And obviously, you are very busy, so we'll let you get back to work.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And now it's time for The Weekend, a new segment where we find out what people in the San Joaquin Valley do for fun when they have a little time off. Today I'm speaking with Carla Chancellor. She's a retired public school teacher who lives in the foothills town of Springville. And about 8 months ago, she took up ballroom dancing. She liked it so much that she started a Dancing in the South Valley meetup and Facebook page. Thanks for speaking with us, Carla.
Oh, I'm happy to talk to you about dancing.
Great. So tell me, what got you into dancing?
My cardiologist told me I needed to do something to de-stress, and going to the gym wasn't working.
What are some opportunities for dancing on summer weekends in the South Valley?
We'll be having summer music in the parks on Friday nights on almost every little town around here. And there's usually a place to dance, and people are dancing to that music. And those are free and lots of fun. Friday nights in Porterville, we have Dance with Lewis, which is line dancing, cardio, and ballroom.
And who's Lewis?
Lewis Aguilar. He's a dance instructor that's from Porterville and has, on the encouragement of friends, started this dance class. His dance class is going to be moving to Porterville College and going to be out there.
Tell me about some of the people you've met dancing. No doubt it's an interesting group.
That's true. It is an interesting group. People want to dance, but they let their fears get the most of them. But the reality is that once you get out there and you walk through the door, you meet people that are so welcoming and so kind and so helpful and forgiving of every mistake that you make, that you can only start learning and start having fun and laughing at yourself.
So has dancing changed your weekends?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, really, I dance every night of the week. I dance in Fresno, Visalia, Hanford, you know, so there's always somewhere to dance. And the meetup has helped that because people look to it and they can find, you know, places to go.
And are there some hidden gyms out there where people should try out dancing?
Well, there's lots of places to take lessons, and I think that's a good icebreaker for everybody. But the smooth dancers always have a lesson first, and it's a mixer, so you meet everybody in the room, and you may be doing bachata or rumba or salsa or cha-cha, whatever it is, but by the time you've gone all the way around the room and danced with every person there, you're totally comfortable because you've made all your mistakes, you've laughed, and you know you're going to have a good time.
And who are the Smooth Dancers?
The Smooth Dancers is a national organization, but there's local chapters. So we have Visalia Smooth Dancers, Bakersfield Smooth Dancers, Fresno Smooth Dancers. And they often will sponsor lessons. Like here in Visalia, there's a Smooth Dancers lesson that is on Sunday afternoons. But they have their social dance once a month, and it will be a lesson, icebreaker, and then a dance.
And so, yes. So what's your plan for dancing this weekend?
Well, my Friday will start with Lewis's dance class in Porterville, and he is a great teacher, and he does not let you take a breath. Also, on Friday night is going to be in Porterville is Music in the Park with Fire in the Mountain, and Tulare dances over there at their community center, have some great bands. Saturday will be the Smooth Dancers in Exeter, the Visalia Smooth Dancers dance in Exeter. And Pete and Carmen are coming down from Fresno, Studio 65, and they'll be teaching salsa Saturday night.
Wow.
In Exeter. Yeah, so that'll be fun. Sundays is Argentine Tango at Fresno State. Saturday we have Argentine Tango in Porterville.
So a lot of footwork for you this weekend.
Oh, every weekend.
All right. Well, Carla, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on social media.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Alice Daniel, and reporters Monica Velez and Laura Sutsui.
Technical support from Marv Ellen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.